This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. They came in rated number one, but may I be so bold as to suggest the Huskies played as if they might be cold, at least for portions of the game that was on tap last night. But at the end, they warmed up, and it all turned out all right, at least if you weren't cheering for Washington. Jim Calhoun, the head coach of the men's basketball team at the University of Connecticut, has characterized his Huskies as a team of lapses. Those lapses added up to 26 turnovers last night, but UConn slipped by the aforementioned Washington 98-92 anyway. In other men's action, Villanova edged Boston College in overtime, 60-59. Villanova's last 2 points came on a goaltending call. Florida beat Georgetown 57-53, and George Mason, an 11 seed having the time of its life in the spotlight, beat Wichita State 63-55. In today's Elite Eight matchups, LSU, conqueror of Mighty Duke, will face Texas in Atlanta, and Memphis will take on UCLA in Oakland. The women's tournament will resume today when number one seed LSU faces DePaul in San Antonio, after which Stanford will play Oklahoma. This evening, Baylor will play Maryland, and Boston College will face Utah in Albuquerque as the very good are whittled down toward the superb. The excitement generated when an underdog surprises a number one seed, the thrill of a buzzer-beating three-pointer. The current NCAA tournament has not been short on drama, but a lot of the impact of the annual televised spectacle is less apparent than the thunderous dunk or the foul shot that falls short. Lawrence Funderburk starred for Ohio State's basketball team in the NCAA tournament 14 years ago, and one of his most enduring memories is of returning to the campus.
We were number one seed back in 1992. We lost to Michigan in the Fab Five to go to the Final Four, and we came back, and people were so distraught and so sad. I mean, you know, and that people get so emotional in it, and that you think as a player, like, man, you let a lot of people down, you know? And that you feel that. You feel like not only the whole weight of the campus, but the city and sometimes the state. It's a lot of pressure.
The pressure doesn't fall exclusively on the players and their coach, whose job may depend on how far his team gets in the tournament. The NCAA and the television networks are currently partners in a deal that pays the Athletic Association $6.2 billion over 11 years. The distribution of some of that money depends on which teams make the tournament and how well they do. Teams earn shares of the pie for themselves and the other schools in their conferences. That's part of the reason that Douglas Fullerton, the commissioner of the Big Sky Conference, is so happy that the University of Montana not only made the tournament, but won their first-round game against Nevada before losing to Boston College in the second round. Commissioner Fullerton hopes for even better Big Sky days in future tournaments.
If you could, you know, win a game 2 or 3 or 4 years in a row, or get two teams in, or heaven forbid, like the Big East, get eight teams in and have four of them win, you can rack up shares in a hurry. And the share cost is right now in the 165 range. So you're talking $1.1 million over 6 years to the conference for that one win.
One of the conference commissioners who was happily surprised by how well his member teams have done in the current tournament is Doug Elgin, who presides over the Missouri Valley Conference. He's sure the profile of the conference in general has risen this spring with the upsets accomplished by two of its schools.
I think there's an identification with our conference. It's much more recognizable out of region. And I think when you have this Cinderella factor like we do with Bradley and Wichita State, I think there's a lot more attention that's brought to bear on our schools and on our league than ever when you make it to a men's Sweet 16 level. But getting two teams to the men's Sweet 16 really does put us over the top in terms of the image and the publicity that we're generating nationally.
That publicity may translate into more applications and increased alumni contributions, but according to Lawrence Funderburk, that's not the money some of the players are thinking about as the tournament rolls on.
You're going to see all kinds of agents. You're going to see all kind of people trying to sell themselves as far as representation, and you have all these people who are going to latch onto them and promise them all these things, and that's where a lot of these kids come from poor backgrounds. They're going to be tempted to take things because a lot of these kids look at themselves as professional athletes on a college level. They're just not getting paid.
Playing brilliantly in the tournament obviously can increase the value of the relatively few college players who will have pro careers. Coaches, too, can benefit from success on college basketball's biggest stage, according to former University of Utah coach Rick Majerus.
Well, I got a better parking spot, when we were successful. But in reality, I think that there's, your bookstore more merchandise-oriented. People walk with a little bit more bounce. And because you draw notoriety to your program, it's very difficult to get noticed for having a superb accounting department, but you're readily noticed for having an excellent athletic department.
So runs the conventional wisdom, and the accounting department might have to be called in to help count the money generated by a successful basketball team. According to the U.S. Department of Education, Louisville's basketball program led the nation with a profit of over $13 million last year, and Arizona was not far behind at $12.5 million. But Smith College professor Andrew Zimbalist, who's been writing about the economics of professional and major college sports for 10 years, warns against misinterpreting the significance of those figures.
What tends to happen is it doesn't any good bureaucracy. If they have some extra cash, they find a way to spend it, and there'll be bonuses and perquisites and parties and new weight rooms and new programs and so on and so forth. So at the end of the day, even though a particular basketball program might show a surplus, it's very unlikely that's going to show up as a surplus that would then aid the university. Nonetheless, there's a culture here, and the culture is, look how exciting all of this is. This must be getting us great advertising, great public relations, and we're going to become a better school because we made the Sweet 16 or we made the Final Four.
Is there any statistic that measures that? I mean, years ago, Boston College talked about huge increase in application during the Doug Flutie era. Is there any way that anybody's successfully measured basketball success as it has spurred more applications and, you know, higher SATs because they had a greater pool of students to choose from, that sort of thing?
Yes, it has been done. I mean, I've done some of those studies, and other economists have done them as well. And although there is the occasional Flutie effect, and that will happen when a school goes from near obscurity all the way to the top of the national rankings, and it happens all of a sudden, you will get large numbers of new applications. But here's the trick. The applications will go up when a school has some meteoric rise in popularity in its sports teams. Applications will go up, and one would think that since there are more applications, the school could be more selective, and that would then lead to a more qualified student body measured by SATs or ACTs or high school class rank or any other measure. But in fact, it doesn't. What it does sometimes do is it leads to more applications. But apparently the kinds of high school kids who are motivated to apply to a school just because they appeared in the Final Four or because they went to a bowl game are not the kinds of kids who will tend to have very high academic qualifications. And even then, Bill, you'll get spikes upward in the number of applications when the team does well, but you can also get spikes downward in the number of applications when the team does poorly. So that at the end of the day, it's very hard to argue that there's any serious and important linkage between athletic success and academic success.
So success, as in getting to the Final Four or winning an NCAA championship, might be measured by a bigger weight room, a larger coach's office, maybe a new arena, but not necessarily university-wide improvement.
That's exactly right, but don't leave out higher bonuses for the coaches, who these days, the lead coaches can get $1.5 million or $2 million. And maybe higher bonuses for the athletic directors as well.
What about general alumni giving? Does it go up when the basketball team succeeds, and does it drop when, for example, a team expected to succeed doesn't fulfill expectations?
Here the evidence is actually somewhat ambiguous. In part, it's ambiguous because we don't have complete access to all the data. Much of the donation and the endowment data is viewed as proprietary, so we don't have a full record. But from what available evidence there is out there, there does seem to be some linkage between the amount of giving and high levels of athletic success. However, the giving also appears to cannibalize giving to the general fund in favor of giving to the athletics department. So the overall level of giving might go up, but that's because there's a large amount of increase in giving to the athletics department, and there could be a small amount of decrease in giving to the general fund.
It sounds as if you're saying that putting a lot of time and energy and money into developing a basketball team that will make it to the Final Four or maybe even win a national championship is not a brilliant economic strategy. So why do so many colleges do it?
Well, implicit in your question, I guess, is the notion that we normally act rationally, and I reject that premise. Look, there is a culture out there that says that we need to attract attention to our school And the more we attract attention to our school, the better our school will become. And there are a bunch of people, I think, who are governed by or consumed by that ideology. And as long as you have people within the system, like the athletic directors, like the coaches, like alums who love sports and go back for the alumni weekend, and go back for homecoming weekend, and like to root for their team, there's a lot of momentum out there that says, this is great stuff. We're having a great time. And so some arguments get spun out of that to say, not only is this great fun, but, you know, we're actually helping ourselves economically. And so you get a juggernaut of a movement that says, boy, this is just the cat's meow for our college. And a college president either goes along because he or she likes sports and is having a good time himself or herself, and they get to go with their family to bowl games in the South. Either they go along for that reason, or they go along because they're, after all, going to be in their job for 6 years on average. And why would they want to go up against the trustees? Why would they want to go up against the alums? Why would they want to go up against the boosters who live in the town and to threaten town-gown relations? It's just much too much of a Herculean task to think that one of these individuals is going to stand up and say enough, enough. College presidents, after all, have an enormous amount of responsibility and plenty of stuff on their agenda without worrying about trying to reform an intercollegiate athletic association that really hasn't been effectively reformed for over 100 years.
Andrew Zimbalist is an economics professor at Smith College. His most recent book is called In the Best Interests of Baseball, The Revolutionary Reign of Bud Selig. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Great. My pleasure.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find the link to our weekly podcasts, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Marlins making waves. We'll see. But first, when the San Francisco Giants open their season a week from Monday, Barry Bonds will be in their lineup. Bonds, who was 8 for 11 with 3 home runs through his first 5 spring training games, is only 7 home runs short of Babe Ruth's 714, another 41 shy of Henry Aaron's 755. Under ordinary circumstances, the chase for the home run record would simply be a great baseball story. But the circumstances surrounding and involving Barry Bonds have not been ordinary since 1998, at least according to journalists Mark Fainaruwata and Lance Williams. The two writers from the San Francisco Chronicle have written Game of Shadows, subtitled Barry Bonds, Balco, and the Steroids Scandal That Rocked Professional Sports. Mark Fainaruwata and Lance Williams join me now from New York. Mark, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
And Lance, thank you very much for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Your book begins, Mark, with the assertion that Bonds decided to begin using steroids because he was jealous of the attention Mark McGwire was getting as a home run hitter, and you attribute that assertion to, quote, a source familiar with Bonds. Who is that source?
Well, I mean, there's two points there. One of the sources is an unnamed source, but the larger source also is Kimberly Bell, Bonds' girlfriend at the time, who is with him on a trip to St. Louis and experiences the sort of jealousy. Some of that jealousy manifests itself when McGwire is being celebrated in 98. I mean, as you remember, 98 is really a year in which McGwire saves baseball in many ways. He's revered. It's sort of a circus-like atmosphere. And at that point, Bonds, we're told, sees this and begins to believe that this is the thing he needs to be doing. He believes McGwire himself is using the substances, and he communicates some of that jealousy through Kim Bell and then some of it through a source who's close to Bonds.
Okay, so Kimberly Bell, a mistress whom Bonds later tells to disappear and threatens, testifies against him. Perhaps no surprise there. But were you uncomfortable presenting Bonds' motivation back in 98 through a source that you won't name?
This is Lance. I'm not uncomfortable with that at all. The source's information in all regards has lined up with the considerable public record material we present in the book. And to speak about Kim Bell, she documents her account of her relationship with Bonds with tapes, plane tickets, correspondence. Her account also lines up with other documentary material.
A lot of the evidence against Bonds and against the other athletes has come from grand jury testimony that was supposed to have remained secret. Was that testimony leaked by law enforcement officials who knew that they couldn't successfully prosecute Bonds and didn't want the case to disappear?
Well, we're certainly not going to characterize the source of the grand jury information we received. But I would also say much of the information about the athletes is not only stemmed from grand jury information, but testimony, but it also stems from statements to federal investigators as well that we've had the opportunity to review. You know, a lot of people have a lot of different motivations within this story as well as every story that a reporter would work on, and we've spent a lot of time sort of trying to get a look at those motivations and judge them for ourselves and make sure that we're presenting truthful information, which we're absolutely confident we are.
Did you have any qualms about using material that you really shouldn't have had access to?
Well, what kind of reporter would you be if you were offered the opportunity to learn the true story of this doping scandal and you turned it down because you thought you might get in trouble for it? I was most interested in the material, and when I saw it, I knew it was highly newsworthy. I also knew we did nothing illegal or inappropriate ourselves to get it. I didn't want to pass on it. Mark didn't, and no one at our paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, wanted to pass on it. We thought it was important and a service to print this material.
Well, and I would point out, too, I mean, it's not like we're out there sort of in a world that's unfamiliar to other reporters. I mean, there's plenty of information over time that one could look at that is, you know, privileged information, secret information that suddenly ends up in the public domain because reporters were diligent enough to find it and dig it up as a public service. So, and that happens at all levels, whether it's political stories, sports stories, or otherwise.
Well, you make a great point there, Mark, and it leads me to ask, why weren't more reporters more energetic pursuing these rumors long before this?
It's a hard story to get. Sports writers write a lot. But finally, I think there was a level of deliberate lack of inquisitiveness on the steroid story. Individual reporters, going back to Tom Verducci at Sports Illustrated, did important pieces about, you know, the game being transformed by steroids. For a long time, the rest of the pack just didn't want to pick up the trail. They wanted to go back to covering games. Huh. I say that as someone who has never covered sports before, just an observation I made working on this story.
The unique thing about this story, obviously, is that it's a federal investigation. You know, if a lot of people have asked us why there were no stories done about McGuire in 98, when clearly there was sort of plenty of swirl around that issue. And my response is I think one of the most significant issues is that there's not a federal investigation going on of McGuire. And what we're able to benefit from in reporting this story is that because of this investigation, there are people being interviewed by federal agents and being forced to testify under oath. And there's documents that come out of those, and those documents have, you know, fortunately become available to us to provide to the public.
I wonder if fear of ridicule wasn't also operating. I remember years ago, Tom Boswell wrote a story about Jose Canseco probably using steroids, and Canseco denied it, of course, at that point, and everybody made fun of Boswell for, you know, trying to find something that wasn't there.
Sure, and Steve Wilstein, the AP writer who broke the story about Mark McGuire's use of Andro, that was the legal supplement that still had been banned by the Olympic Committee, he popped that story in August of 98 in the middle of the home run chase, mm-hmm. and he was, you know, there was outrage, but it wasn't directed at McGuire, it was directed at the AP writer.
Bonds was involved with Balco Labs, Victor Conti's business, where numbers of football players, track and field athletes, baseball players did obtain illegal performance-enhancing drugs. Victor Conti himself, who's now in prison, has acknowledged that. But why has Victor Conti so vehemently denied that he ever provided steroids to Bonds or that he ever admitted to investigators that he had done so?
I think that part of what's going on is a semantics game from Victor Conti. He was providing the substances to Greg Anderson, the trainer, and the trainer was then providing those substances to Bonds. Conti has at once tried to sort of talk about the widespread use of the substances and on the other hand tried to convey that he never was a snitch and never gave up any of the athletes. And Bonds, as the sort of most significant figure in the case, would be the biggest person for him to so-called snitch on. So I think there's a lot of issues at work with him, and it's a difficult chore to try and get inside his head.
You know, we believe he told the truth when he told the federal agent that he gave drugs to those 27 athletes, including Bonds. Although he has complained that he was misquoted in that statement, he backed away from a legal proceeding where he was going to put on evidence and cross-examine the federal agent and prove to the world that he had been framed in that interview. He dropped that matter and instead pleaded guilty.
You maintain that each new chapter of baseball's steroid scandal has found the commissioner just kind of hoping it would all go away, and you point out that Mr. Selig has been thinking about a celebration of Bonds' historic home runs in 2006. What might the commissioner have done differently?
He could have enforced rules that were in existence. For example, Greg Anderson, the accused steroid dealer, shouldn't have had the run of the Giants clubhouse, according to the old Pete Rose rule, as they called it, to run undesirables and sketchy characters out of the behind the scenes at baseball. Commissioner Selig could have ordered Bonds not to continue training with Greg Anderson after Anderson was indicted for steroid dealing. I mean, those are just little things within the rules that I don't think would have been hard for him to accomplish at all. The bigger job would have been to try to amp up the steroid testing program before he did, and also to try to inquire into what was going on just in a factual way.
Neither the commissioner nor the San Francisco Giants did anything to get Anderson out of the clubhouse or to change Bonds' training regimen. Was it simply that they were afraid of alienating the goose that was laying those 72, 73 golden eggs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly what was happening. I mean, Anderson gets indicted. There's no discussion whatsoever of Bonds not training with him at any point during this time. One of the things that I think is most telling about the Giants in particular and their dealing with this is even after Anderson has been indicted and I believe it's even after he's pleaded guilty, the Giants basically circumvent Major League Baseball's rules and hire two of Bonds' other personal trainers to be part of the team so that they can continue to work with Bonds. There's clearly a level of avoidance going on at all levels.
Your title, Game of Shadows, turns up in a sentence in Chapter 18 that reads as follows: competitive sports, it turned out, was part mirage, a game of shadows. Do you mean to suggest that Bonds and Jason Giambi and Marion Jones and the rest were simply doing what everybody else was doing throughout contemporary, quote, competitive sports?
I'm not sure we would make such an all-encompassing remark, but we do want to convey that the results on the field, the games that fans watch being played, are being determined by factors that fans have been totally unaware of, that some of the key vectors, if you will, that decide athletic competition now are who your chemist is and so forth, and that chemist is, in most cases, totally unknown to the world.
I'm wondering whether your co-author shares what sounds like a very dark attitude towards the sports landscape in general.
I'm the optimist in the crew.
Yeah, the co-author shares the view. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we've talked about a few times is this notion of, you know, why Balco? You know, does it just represent the singular notion of Bonds and these other athletes? And I would argue that to believe that Balco is an aberration and the sort of singular steroid mill in the country would be a naive sort of thing to believe.
Mark Fanaruwata and Lance Williams are the authors of Game of Shadows, Barry Bonds, Balco, and the Steroid Scandal That Rocked Professional Sports, published by Gotham Books. They spoke to me from New York. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Lance, I appreciate your joining me.
You bet.
Yesterday, Barry Bonds and his lawyers asked for a temporary injunction against profits stemming from Game of Shadows. That request was denied by Judge James Warren, who cited free speech protections. Warren also said Bonds' lawsuit had little chance of succeeding. Fanaruwata, San Francisco Chronicle Executive Vice President Phil Bronstein, and Gotham Books spokeswoman Lisa Johnson all said yesterday that they stand firmly behind the book. The mostly anonymous Florida Marlins lineup currently preparing in Jupiter, Florida for the 2006 Major League Baseball season is likely to be the same one taking the field on opening day. The Marlins dismantled the team that won the World Series just 3 years ago, but as Ron Schachter reports, the current school of thought is that the Marlins have the rest of Major League Baseball right where they want it.
Miami Herald baseball reporter Clark Spencer says that this year's Marlins are so inexperienced that a bunch of them struck out against the team's pitching machine earlier this spring. Granted, it was throwing curveballs, but Spencer, who's covered the Marlins since 1999, is figuring on an especially long season for the home team.
Well, they pretty much lost everybody between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Of the eight starting position players on last year's opening day team, only one remains. Of their top three starters, two are now gone. They lost their closer, who saved 40 games for them last year. No team in free agency in the free agent era has had this much roster turnover in one off season.
The purge has left Florida's few remaining veterans, utility infielder Lenny Harris included, scratching their heads.
None of us expected it. We pretty much look at it as a business move and nothing we could do about it, but we have to just go out and do what we do and play baseball and don't worry about what the front office does.
The Marlins fell short in the NL East last season, and after failed efforts to get a new publicly funded ballpark in Miami, they've cut their payroll from $65 million to under $20 million. During the offseason, the team dealt slugging first baseman Carlos Delgado to the Mets, Fleet center fielder Juan Pierre to the Cubs, and starting pitcher and 2003 World Series hero Josh Beckett to the Red Sox. The Toronto Blue Jays, meanwhile, signed former Marlins starter A.J. Burnett as a free agent. The Marlins still have pitcher Dontrell Willis, who won 22 games last year and finished second in the National League Cy Young voting, and 22-year-old phenom Miguel Cabrera, who batted .323 and hit 33 home runs. But the team may also start as many as five rookies. The Herald Spencer points out that the franchise has been down this road before, after winning the 1997 World Series.
When they dismantled the 1997 team, they traded most of their top-line players in exchange for prospects, young prospects. They got a number of players. A.J. Burnett they got from the Mets. And by the fact that they were so bad, they also got a high draft pick, the second overall pick in 99, and they used that to get Josh Beckett. So their strategy was to gather as much top young talent as possible, nurture that talent, and try to mold it into a championship team. It sounds difficult, but it does work.
That success story was not lost on rookie manager Joe Girardi when he took the job in the offseason.
I knew there'd be changes, and the level of changes depended on the stadium deal. And I was willing to take that chance. You got to look at people's track records. You know, history usually repeats itself, and they're not always going to be right, but their track record speaks for itself.
Although the Marlins have been wooed by San Antonio, Oklahoma City, and Portland, Oregon, they continue to play in the inhospitable confines of the Miami Dolphins football stadium, where last season they ranked 28th in the majors in attendance.
Batting third, playing first base, number 17, Mike Jacobs. Jacobs, first base.
Those fans who come to see the Marlins this season will find rookies Mike Jacobs at first, Hanley Ramirez at short, and Jeremy Hermita in the outfield. Last September, Hermita became the first player in more than a century to hit a grand slam in his first big league at bat. But he insists that the new crop of Marlins won't try to take on too much too soon.
I don't think any particular player goes out there feeling they have to carry any type of load. You know, I think it's nine guys on the field, and you go out there and do your part every day and do your one thing to help this team win a ball game. And whether it's backing up a base, whether it's, you know, taking an extra base on a ball in the gap, or just those little things like that, you know, it's something that we're priding on as individuals to help us make a bigger team.
Fans like Bud Vallade, who has followed the Marlins since 1993, the team's first season, are also adjusting their expectations.
I think these guys are going to come out here and play with a lot of enthusiasm and energy. Last year's team just underperformed terribly. Had a lot of high-paid superstars, but they didn't get the job done, you know, at the bottom line. And I think they performed well below what they were expected to do. These guys, you know, again, no expectations. I think every victory is going to be celebrated and maybe not anticipated. So it should be fun to watch again.
But with the emergence of their young prospects and the likelihood of some high draft picks down the road, the Marlins may have the rest of the league just where they want it. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Jupiter, Florida.
Batting second, serving as the Marlins designated hitter today, number 6, Dan Rudloff.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Dune Buggies doing donuts in the desert. But first, a look at the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Gonzaga is gone and henceforth not getting Zaggy with it at all in this year's big dance. I guess Adam Morrison and teammates lacked the necessary bulldog skin.
Thursday night was a great night of entertainment. The West Virginia-Texas game, the Duke-LSU game, the Gonzaga-UCLA game were all terrific television shows. All three of them, though, contained down-the-stretch shots egregiously offensive against Basketball Camp 101 that it's almost hard to imagine. Point the first. Duke, the cerebral favorite in this tournament, comes out in the last minute of the game, gives up a dunk on its full-court press, and then twice gives up offensive rebounds and free throws, including one on which the only guy on the line for LSU was the shooter. Then West Virginia ties the game against Texas with a brilliant three-pointer by Kevin Pitsnoggle, and then doesn't stop the ball coming down the other way. And then third and finally, Gonzaga, whose coach Mark Few is allegedly up for a bunch of other jobs, has to throw the famous Christian Laettner pass to try to win a game it has already blown, and Adam Morrison, the player of the year, is in the backcourt, and they throw the ball to J.P. Batista, who couldn't throw the ball in Puget Sound if he was standing on the beach. Now, I don't care that Adam Morrison was in the middle of an emotional breakdown. Him sobbing like an Irish widow at a wake is a better bet from 25 feet than J.P. Batista is. I couldn't believe these three games, and what's worse, they've turned me into Bob Ryan.
I think you sound as if a man who had the three losing teams in your brackets.
I have no brackets this year, by the way. It's a classic example of all the good and all the bad in college basketball. They were tremendous entertainment, great stories, and at the most critical moment, one team made horrendous basketball plays.
By virtue of defeating Gonzaga on Thursday, UCLA takes on Memphis today. Any chance the Bruins, looking so hideous at the beginning of that game on Thursday night, make it all the way to the Final Four? Final Four, Final Four, I'm not afraid to say it.
The only team of the ones that are left that I have not seen a minute of this year is Memphis. I've been waiting for them to fall on their face in the national stage. They haven't done it. I don't think if UCLA gets down by 17 to Memphis, they'll be able to come back. I think if UCLA gets down by 17 to Memphis, they're going to lose by 25. UCLA cannot have a first half like it had against Gonzaga.
What about on the women's side? Which of the games will you watch today?
Well, out in Albuquerque, the Lady BC Eagles, having knocked off top-seeded Ohio State the other night, get to play Utah, and then will play either Baylor or Maryland.
You're assuming they'll beat Utah.
If they beat Utah, mm-hmm. to make it to the Women's Final Four, which is being held where, Bill?
Right here.
Thank you very much.
In our fair city.
So I believe the Boston College team has a lot more to play for than most of these folks do.
Paul Tagliabue announced this week that he will retire as commissioner of the National Football League. How will his administration be remembered?
Paul Tagliabue's tenure will be remembered for relative labor peace, establishing a collective bargaining agreement, and maintaining and keeping the ship upright during the events after September 11th, when he sort of set the tone for all of sports, professional and college, in those awful couple of weeks.
George Steinbrenner has spent a lot of money over the years building and rebuilding the Yankees. How do you like his plan to rebuild the Bronx over the next 40 years?
Well, let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that George Steinbrenner is not going to live to the age of 118.
I think that's fair.
We don't even know who's going to be handing out this money 40 years from now. We don't know if there's going to be a Bronx 40 years from now. We don't know, with bird flu and everything else, whether there's going to be baseball 40 years from now. The Yankees want to build a new stadium. They want to knock down the old Yankee Stadium and build a new one on the same spot. They've given up trying to get a stadium anywhere in New York, thank God. And now they're going to start paying the Bronx 40 years worth of bribes, community service money, to knock it down and build it in the same place. I'm at the age, Bill, where somebody promises to keep paying me 40 years from now. I don't necessarily trust them, so I guess I'm just cynical.
People complaining that the NBA is taking too many young players into the league may be happy to learn that Sean Kemp, age 36 and having been retired for 3 years, wants to return. Is the NBA ready for Sean Kemp, the sequel?
No. David Stern is banging his head off his desk in New York right now saying, this is a problem I don't need. He's only 36 years old, but during his last year with the NBA, he weighed 320 pounds. He claims he has slimmed down to 270 through an exercise regime. He's had legal troubles. He's had paternity suit troubles. He's a problem nobody's going to want. Nobody's going to take this guy on.
Well, I don't know if Sean Kemp is the answer, Charlie, but the NBA better look for something to improve its ratings. On Sunday, a game between the Lakers and the Cavaliers was outdrawn by the broadcast of a NASCAR rainout, which must have delighted Mr. NASCAR.
It's extraordinary what people will watch. More to the point, it also beat out PGA.
Absolutely.
Which golf for a weekend for sedentary types like nobody I know is enormously popular. And to say that neither one of these sports could outrate what is essentially a studio show about automobiles, which I thought was sort of, you know, locked into those Guthy Ranker spots at 2 o'clock in the morning, is a pretty frightening thing for the NBA and the PGA.
Britain's finance minister expected to be celebrated when he froze a scheduled increase in the champagne tax this week. Charlie, he said that it was because he wanted to make sure that Brits celebrating the World Cup win by England, which he is sure will occur this summer in Germany, would have sufficient drink. Where did he goof?
He goofed by not reckoning with the substantial portion of his political base that drinks beer. Chancellor of the Exchequer, Brown. You know, you cannot say that without pronouncing it that way. Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, having ducked the hike in the champagne tax, increased the beer duty by 1 pence per pint. Basically, what you're doing is avoiding a tax on the thing people drink half a glass of after the game and increasing it on the thing people drink 50 glasses of during the game.
On Monday, Mac Weekly caught a 25-pound largemouth bass out of a California lake, which would have been a world record had he chosen to make it official. Anyway, it was apparently the same fish with which another angler had set a previous record, only the beast was a few pounds lighter than. This is one camera-hogging fish, no?
Or a stupid one.
I mean, this could be
the dumbest fish in the history of fish.
Come on, learn. Don't bite that thing.
I mean, you could catch this thing by holding a piece of bread in the water, it looks like.
And finally, my candidate for most passionate football fan ever, anywhere, is one Tank Carter. Do you agree?
Yes. Tank was supposed to go to jail in Broward County, Florida, on January 6th for driving under a revoked license. He was supposed to do 6 months and then get out. But his brother Tyrone told him, look, here I am. I'm a safety on the Pittsburgh Steelers, and we can be in the Super Bowl. So Tank blows off his date with the Broward County authorities, goes to Detroit, watches Tyrone and the Steelers win the Super Bowl, parties with Snoop Dogg, comes back, and the circuit judge in Broward County increases his sentence from 6 months to 5 years. 5 years for driving with an extended license? For going to the Super Bowl and for hanging out with Snoop Dogg when I have a feeling Judge Kaplan couldn't get tickets.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Dumb fish. Really dumb fish.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Last November, while much of the country suffered through a Thanksgiving weekend snowstorm, about 200,000 people converged on Southern California's Imperial Sand Dunes, a breathtakingly beautiful desertscape nearly half the size of New York City. Some compete in the dune buggy races, which take place there from November to May, for the competition. Some go for the camaraderie, but as Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder reports, some hit the dunes to find family.
At the southern end of the Imperial Sand Dunes, about 30 miles east of Calexico, California and Mexicali, Mexico, a lone pillar stands. It marks the Mexican border that right now is being crisscrossed by dozens of off-road enthusiasts, or buggy people, as they call themselves. This holiday weekend, they're here to race quad runners, sand railers, a larger, more sophisticated version of a dune buggy, and dirt bikes across the dunes. Well, almost everyone, that is.
The engine, I guess the clamp or something came loose on the radiator hose, and they just tightened it up. It overheated, so we're adding water to it to cool the engine down, and hopefully they'll take care of it. If not, we'll have to take the car back and get a different one.
That's Tammy Gertson. She's part of a large Arizona contingent who've made the trip west for the weekend. It's her friend's car, the bright yellow five-seater with a Corvette engine, that's giving the men, self-described motorheads, a real headache. It's a hot, very windy, very dry day, and the five guys huddled around the overheating engine are starting to get desperate.
We're taking all the water that we were going to drink and putting it into the car so it runs properly.
Yeah, well, so it cools the engine down, because you don't want an engine failure out in the middle of the dunes.
While the men work on the car, I take the opportunity to talk with Sherry Nelson, the one with the car trouble. I ask her, what makes driving around a bunch of sand so much fun?
Yeah, it's unpredictable because you never know, like, when you jump a Razorback, what's on the other side, so you have to go off at an angle, otherwise you don't know if it's a free fall or if there's another car or quad. So you're constantly looking for the terrain. Once you're up on one side of a bowl, you're looking across the terrain to see what the other bowls look like, so you know exactly, you know, whether you want to go up to the side of the Razorback or if you want to stay where you're at.
The Razorbacks Sherry's talking about are narrow ridges of a white sand so fluffy that it might one day find itself inside an Augusta National bunker. That is, unless the desert wind blows it away before it can make the trip to Georgia.
And it's a lot like the ocean, where the sand is always shifting. The wind shifts the sand, so you could be out here one weekend and cruise and just get the feel for it, and then you come out the next weekend, it's all different, because the wind has shifted the sand and moved it, and your paths are no longer. You're looking for a new route.
The dune's ever-evolving state is just one of the reasons environmentalists don't want buggy people racing here. In fact, only one-third of the dunes are open to off-road activity. In 1978, the northern third of the dunes was shut down, and in 2000, another third was closed to protect a threatened plant, Pearson's Milk Vetch. Our drinking water cools the engine, and the caravan is ready to tackle the dunes. Five cars start their engines. Mike Gertson is my pilot. He sits behind the wheel while his wife Tammy rides shotgun. The couple from Yuma, Arizona, assembled their buggy from scratch. They named it Sand Jaws and detailed its sides with a caricature of an angry-looking shark. Sand Jaws boasts a wide 130-inch wheelbase. It's basically a metal cage on wheels, which makes it a heck of a lot lighter than your average Honda, and a lot faster. Oh, I forgot one thing. It goes from 0 to 60 in 1, 2, 3 seconds. Needless to say, it doesn't take us long to get to the dunes.
Basically, I'm in the back seat of Mike's car right now, and we're about to go around the corner and eat a bunch of sand. We're going to go another... Whoa! Oh, my God. All right, we got... Oh, my... It's kind of hard to talk every time we go around a corner. I eat a bunch of sand. We're going up a hill. Oh, my God. Basically, we're inside of a bowl right now, and we're thinking that we're at about a 45-degree angle to the earth. And I'm basically holding on. I don't know how sand can get through these goggles, but it just did. I got some sand in my right eye. That's all right. It's a pretty amazing... Yeah, I'm good. It's a pretty amazing experience, especially when you get inside the bowl and you're going on about a 45-degree angle and you're just kind of holding on for dear life. You got about two cars in front of you. And they're... Oh, my God! Whoa! This is pretty amazing right now. It's unbelievable. It feels like you're in Saudi Arabia.
After the greatest roller coaster ride of my life, the caravan makes its way back to a makeshift campground formed by seven RVs parked in a circle. I pop into Mike Gertzen's RV, and over some leftover turkey, we talk about why the dunes are so popular.
I think a lot of it has to do with inviting your neighbor to come. Hey, let's go to the dunes for a weekend. And much of the people here were not in the off-road industry 5 years ago. If you look at the activity this weekend in the dunes, is probably close to 200,000 people. If you look at it 10 years ago, if it was 50,000 people, I would have been really surprised. And if you go back 20 years ago, it was probably 1,000 people. It has just risen in popularity. And I guess so much of it has to do with, you know, hey, Mom and Dad, we really had a good time with you in the dunes this weekend.
Mike and Tammy's dune family isn't blood. They're mostly work buddies from a heavy machinery dealer back in Arizona.
We consider ourselves family, and I'm related to nobody in this camp except for my wife. Yet I consider these my friends and family, and we really push the family part of this because the kids go with us. The kids learn about the safe operation of vehicles. The kids learn about preserving the environment, not leaving trash down. And it's a win-win situation. And it's an educational opportunity because these dunes are an active biological activity going on. There's things going on in these dunes. But within the dunes, there's nothing we hurt. We go through it, and the wind comes up. 6 hours later, the tracks are gone.
When those tracks disappear and the dunes return to their buggyless beauty, it's easy to see why Hollywood chooses to shoot movies here.
This is where Return of the Jedi, that's where this was filmed, right here.
The original Star Wars movie was made out here.
Yeah, and also Scorpion King.
And it's just as easy to see why environmentalists don't like buggy people racing around, and why thousands of families keep coming back.
We want to come back next week, and we want to keep it so we can come back the week after and the week after and the week after.
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Gray's Well, California.
Little dune buggy in the sand. Little blue dune buggy in my hand.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Game of Shadows, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Charlie Schroeder, that scourge of the sand dunes.
Whoa!
I hope we're not paying this guy. It sounds like he's having far too much fun for this to be called work. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Little blue dune buggy in my hand. Little blue dune buggy. 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 Little blue dune buggy.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public.